opportunity in a rather presumptuous one that I am taking to express in the name of all the participants our very deep appreciation to all of you at Marriott College for making this encounter possible. And I might add my very deep admiration for the creativity that has gone into the planning. And I know that tonight is just the beginning of some very deep and very meaningful experiences for all of us. I am happy to have the opportunity to introduce Father Divide. And as I was thinking of introduction, I hope you won't mind if I give a very brief tale of one of my own experiences as an introduction first, more or less to get us in the spirit of what we are going to be doing. I visited a Benedictine school one year, which my sister was teaching kindergarten. It was right after Christmas when I went into the kindergarten hoping to make myself at home and well known. And as I sat down at the little table in the kindergarten talking with the five-year-old, I decided one way to introduce myself was to find out what they were interested in. So I asked them what they had received for Christmas. And the first little girl said, "I received a dolly." And I answered, "What is your dolly's name?" And she said, "Anne." "Isn't that a nice name? That's my name, too." So I went on to the next and the next and the next and learned about the ball and the policeman's uniform that all of the young children had received. Thought I had been very successful as I leaned back after the sixth child when the first little girl looked up at me and said, "I'm going to change my dolly's name." Father, I hope that I do a little better in introducing you. As I thought about what we are entering into in the next few days, I thought one of the best ways to begin an introduction to Father Divard was to choose a short paragraph from one of his own writings on Paul Tillich that expresses to my mind his own approach to theology and something of the kind of approach to thoughtful and critical discussion that we will be having in the next two or three days. I'm quoting from a paragraph written in 1961, published in 1962, that I think characterizes very well what we are thinking today in 1971. Father wrote, "The function of theology, Catholic or Protestant, is to purify the faith of believers through an enlightened criticism of empirical Christianity. Catholic theology achieves this through a self-criticism, whereby the theologian brings his own Christianity as thought and experience in line with requirements of the Word of God, spoken in Scripture, and echoed in the Church of yesterday and today. Thence, from man to man, from teacher to student, from lecturer to listener, from writer to reader, a continuous self-reformation tends to spread abroad. This is why all great theology is prophetic. While never speaking in the name of a church, a prophetic theology gives the lead to the church of tomorrow by helping men to welcome the hierarchical teaching into a fully scriptural and traditional background." I chose that because I feel that Father Divard is indeed a prophet theologian, or a theological prophet. Long before being ecumenical was popular, Father was writing and lecturing on the whole theme of ecumenism. And some of his works indicate this. As early as 1955, he wrote The Catholic Approach to Protestantism. Two works in 1959, The Church, the Layman in the Modern World, and Protestantism, a volume in the 20th Century Encyclopedia of Catholicism. The next year, in 1960, two works were printed, The Holy Writ, or The Holy Church, The Crisis of the Protestant Reformation, Protestant Hope and the Catholic Responsibility. In 1962, we are still prior to the Council, Paul Tillich and the Christian Message, from which I read you an excerpt a minute ago. And in 1964, The Quest for Catholicity. I'm not going into the details of Father's extensive experience in England and on the continent, or his coming to this country and the work he has done since in the various institutions that most of you are familiar with. I'm rather interested in the fact that in his prophetic quest as a theologian, he has continued to move, always a step ahead of the times. He is now writing and working on the ideas that will be embodied in the talk he is giving us tonight. It interested me very much to know that long before the Church is publicly affirming, as it is at the Synod and has been in the last year or two, its interest in women, the feminine principle, and I'm anxious to know how he develops this, Father Devard has been working, doing research, and thinking about this idea. I have one idea to give to you for a special prayer. We were talking at dinner, and Father was speaking of this very interesting experience teaching at the Methodist Seminary in Columbus, Ohio. He also mentioned that the publishers aren't interested in scholarly works today, particularly on this particular topic. So I say, women of the world, unite. Let us get Father's book published after he finishes his lecture. Father Devard.
Perhaps I ought to start with a kind of warning about the formidable title I have for my talk. The notion of principle might call to mind philosophical concerns, high academic intellectual dissertations. But the point of view I want to adopt here is not at that kind of level. I think there are several ways of approaching principles, and the one I will adopt is, I think, very simple, although I may not be able to put it in very simple terms. I will approach the question of the feminine principle in recent Catholic thought from the point of view of language, simply because theology uses language, whether this language is simply borrowed from ordinary vernacular or has been refined technically in one way or another. Thought is always largely determined, and it is certainly limited by the linguistic tools that we have at our disposal. And this is true also of theological thought. Our theology depends largely on speaking habits that are usually not theologically inspired or theologically oriented. So I would like to start with a question. What does the word woman mean? Because if we speak of a feminine principle, whatever we put exactly under the word principle is going to depend largely on what we mean by the word woman. I will try to answer that first and then relate to that answer some fairly recent statements on women coming from Catholic circles. Now, I will answer the question of language in a certain framework with which perhaps you are not extremely familiar, so I will explain this framework first. Among the various approaches of contemporary science toward language, there is one that is sometimes called structuralist. Again, you mustn't be frightened by the word. The basis of it is that the meaning of a term is not found only in the word itself when it is taken alone, or even in the correspondence between the word and the object that the word refers to. Word and object taken together form one sign, a linguistic sign, the full meaning of which appears only in its relationship with other signs. In order to determine the meaning of a word, and here this is the word woman I'm concerned with, we must first answer the question, what does this term stand in opposition to in our language? Facing the word woman, there is another word that is related to it, and in relation to it, we understand, we give meaning to this term woman. Of course, common sense knows what we designate by the word woman. And the question of what does the word woman stand in opposition to would be superfluous if we were concerned only about the strict denotation of the term, about the abstraction constituted by the composite image of the women we know, and of our fantasies about woman. In a correspondence theory of language in which word and object stand in strict correlation to each other, the question itself also would be superfluous. But a word has, besides a strict connotation, which is always more or less abstract, it has the possibility of acquiring great richness of connotation. For instance, if you take the word chair, a chair, strictly speaking, in its denotation is an object made to be sat upon, but a chair may also evoke many other things. It may, of course, evoke the comfort needed by my tired limbs after giving a talk. It may evoke the aesthetic lines of a well-made chair, or the suggestive power of a painting by Van Gogh, or perhaps even such theological conceptions as the chair of Peter. So the connotations of the term are far broader than the strict meaning of it. These connotations can be characterized by relationships of opposition or contrast, A contrasted with what is not A, by relationships of contradiction or antithesis, A contradicted by anti-A, by relationships of implication, A implying B, C, D, E, etc., or of presuppositions, when A presupposes B, C, D, E, F. And to this one should add also an indefinite possibility of associations and of combinations in by the syntax of a language. The central diagram of these relationships form what may be called the quadrilateral of meaning. The full meaning of a term emerges from its contrast with what it is not, with its contradiction with what is against it, with its implications and its presuppositions. So in practice, this requires at least four terms or ideas, the one whose denotation and connotation, whose meaning we seek, and then its contrasted opposite, that which it is not, then its antithesis and its implications. Now, from this point of view, the word woman reveals a fundamental cleavage in meaning. Insofar as the term woman may be used with two different contrasts, namely man as human being and man as male. The word man in English has two meanings. In some other languages, there are two words that denote two different aspects of the word man in English. On the one hand, you have the word that stands for mankind, you know, Adam in Hebrew, Anthropos in Greek, Homo in Latin, Mensch in German. On the other hand, we have the word standing for male, you know, Ish in Hebrew, Aner in Greek, Vir in Latin, and Man in German. So our word man means either man as human being or man as male. And therefore the scope of the term woman and the connotations attached to it will differ widely according to our fundamental choice of the one or the other contrast. Let us look briefly at the two options. In the first case, woman faces man as human being. It faces it as its contrasted opposite, namely as that which is not woman. I say as that which is not woman rather than as that which woman is not, in order to avoid lengthy discussions about the word is, because in this problematic, woman is not mankind. It is man who is mankind. Yet she is not entirely outside mankind. I think it is possible to conceive of a language in which man, as mankind, would be not simply different from woman, but antithetic to woman. And then we would have the phenomenon that mankind would be that which woman is not, and woman would be outside of mankind, not a human being, but something like an animal or a slave. But our languages are more ionic than that, or more humane. They have simply made man a whole in which woman is a part, or of which she is an aspect. Now, if this is the basis in language for our conception of woman, then it follows that as soon as we venture outside the sphere of language itself and we enter that of social relationships, the two parts of mankind do not belong to the same level. Numerically, they may be just about equal, yet they are never equal socially, culturally, politically, ecclesiastically. Woman is always less than half of man. As a part of the whole mankind, she is defined first in relation to the whole, then in relation to her specific function in the whole, and finally in relation to the rest of the whole. Her relation to the whole, which is man, makes it impossible for her to be equal to man, since man is the whole. Her relation to a specific function, which may be briefly described as that of wife and mother, makes her supreme in this domain, since nobody else can fulfill these functions. But her relation to her counterpart in mankind, to man as male, subordinates her to him, for the obvious reason that he has already been identified with the whole of mankind. If we may use the Hebrew words, if Ish is also Adam, then of course Isha, the woman, relates to Adam only through Ish. woman belongs to mankind by way of her subordination to the male. And we can recognize in this the social systems of many lands. This has been embodied in the laws of many countries, in which the woman has civic status only insofar as she is under the protection of the predominant man in the family. Let us now look at the other option. In this other option, there is no attempt to relate woman to man as mankind, because the opposite number is simply man as a human male. Woman is then defined and understood in relation to him, in relation to the male, to that which is not woman. Of course, I assume the best translation of this contrast, I assume that in our linguistic quadrilateral, the male is simply the contrast rather than the antithesis of woman. He is not woman rather than anti-woman. Although I have some suspicion that an investigation of the Freudian background of modern society, of advertising, of the sex literature at all levels, of the sex movies, would show the male of the race as anti-woman rather than as not woman. But it makes a little practical difference whether the female stands to the male as that which he is not or as that which is against him. For as soon as woman is defined as the female facing the male, then the only possible relationship between them is sexual in the biological meaning of the term. This appears perhaps more clearly in the French language, in which the word femme means either woman or wife. Perhaps it's also obvious in the popular use of the word girl, which stands for a girl or my girl. And to this system of man-woman relationships, I would ascribe the more or less philosophical view which describes woman in terms of passivity as opposed to male activity, or the romanticism that makes her into the aesthetic object par excellence, or the cruder assumption exemplified by Playboy magazine. I'm sure you know what that is, even if you don't read it every week. That sees her as an object to play with, but not to which you can relate as a human being. Now, these two possibilities in understanding the term woman shows that this term is radically ambiguous. This ambiguity deriving from the chief points to which the term can be referred. When we speak, do we mean woman as part of mankind or woman as female? When we refer to man, do we include or exclude woman from the scope of this world? Do we mean male when we say man and female when we say woman? Or do we have in mind two parts or aspects or dimensions of mankind? These ambiguities can be multiplied indefinitely by the associations that our experience adds to our basic language. Any person's use of the term woman is of course colored by his or her experiences with women, which are themselves bias by his or her fundamental experience as man or as woman. Thus, woman suffers from ambiguities from which man escapes, because man has the advantage of being rightly or wrongly, but more probably wrongly, identified with the whole of mankind. Now, I have introduced these reflections on language because it is in their light that I would like to consider some statements on woman that I find in fairly recent Catholic literature. The language that is used by theologians and priests and bishops and popes even is of course tainted by the language itself which is at our disposal. I will begin by contrasting together two speeches. They are not actually speeches, but they were addresses made during the Second Vatican Council. They were not speeches because they were not pronounced at the council itself, but they were written speeches communicated to the commission of the council. In October 1965, while the Second Vatican Council was debating the proposed constitution on the Church in the modern world, two American bishops sent to the relevant commission some remarks about the position of women in the Church and in the world of today. The first text I want to consider is from the late Archbishop Hallinan of Atlanta. The suggestions made by the Archbishop included the confession that, quote, "the Church has been slow in denouncing the degradation of women in slavery and in claiming for them the right of suffrage and economic equality," end of quote. And then the Archbishop regretted that women have not yet achieved equality with men in the secular world, even in areas where they would be perfectly competent. And after this remark, he proposed 4 points that would tend toward an implementation of this equality in the Church. These are the 4 points in the words of the Archbishop. He asked first that the Church define the liturgical functions of women so that they could serve as lectors and acolytes, and when properly prepared, also as they once did in the apostolic office of deaconess, they could thus, as deacons do, administer certain sacraments. This was the first suggestion. The second one, that the project of a constitution on the Church in the modern world, that the project should include them in the instruments to be set up after the council to further the lay apostolate. The third point was that women religious should have representation in those matters which concern their interests, especially in the present and post-conciliar agencies. Of course, this means particularly in the congregation of religious in Rome. The fourth point was that every opportunity should be given to women, both as sisters and as laywomen, to offer their special talents to the ministry of the Church. Mention should be made of the women who are not married because of the universal call to woman in the document already adopted on the nature of the church. Women also promote family values, that's unmarried women, also promote family values by witnessing in their own way to this universal vocation. Now these are the four points presented by Archbishop Hallinan, intending toward achieving a more complete equality between men and women in the church. It is the ideal of equality which undergirds this short statement of goals. The four points of this program assume that women enjoy a basic natural right to do what men themselves do. It is obvious that men do fulfill liturgical functions, that men will certainly be among the instruments of application of the conciliar decisions, that men are represented in all Roman congregations, and that men have opportunity to offer their talents to the ministry of the church. Thus, the one point of reference for the status and role of women in the church is implicitly defined as being men. Woman herself is not described. Her needs are not analyzed. Her wishes and aspirations are not mentioned for what they may be in themselves, but what they may be in relation to man. It is man in this text who provides the standard for feminine behavior in the church. Woman must be enabled to participate in the tasks of mankind, which are themselves determined by what man actually does, or at least is able to do. I need not dwell on the secular background of this aspiration in our times, except to know that it has always been unavoidable, yet ambiguous and dangerous, for the church to borrow her practical standards from ambient secular culture. But since I am concerned here with the linguistic aspects of the problem, at least this is the angle from which I approach it, I will note that the request made at the council by Archbishop Hallinan and echoed since then by a mounting literature of contestation rests on an implicit contrast between woman and man as mankind. Mankind being identified with man and its tasks and functions determined by man. In other words, the requests of the Archbishop of Atlanta were made within what I've called the first quadrilateral of meaning that I analyzed. I may sound as if I was criticizing an archbishop, but this is very common today, you know. So don't be surprised. There was another American bishop who, at about the same time, came forward in favor of some statement on the rights of women. Again, this was not in a public speech, but in a written communication to the relevant commission. This comes from the pen of Bishop Fulton Sheen, and his approach is very different from that of the Archbishop of Atlanta. The text began in this way. It was to a woman that the promise of salvation was given. The news of the incarnation was given to a woman. Christ first appeared to a woman after his resurrection. A woman spoke for humanity when humble Mary's fiat responded to the creative fiat of the Heavenly Father. Obviously, in this beginning, we can recognize allusions to Eve, to Mary, to Mary Magdalene, and again to Mary. Bishop Sheen then goes on in his text, citing more evidence of the actions and activities of women as recorded in the New Testament. And then he formulates his understanding of the specific qualities that are proper to women. The text goes on then. These qualities proper to women can be characterized as purity, protection of the weak, sacrifice, procreation, the sustaining and caring of human life. End of quote. In the mind of the bishop, these qualities correspond to the general nature and function of motherhood. But he insists that today motherhood cannot be understood only in the physiological sense of the term. If motherhood can be physical, it can also be spiritual and social. On the basis, then, of the concept of social motherhood, Bishop Sheen came out very strongly in favor of the social involvement of women and of their freedom to fulfill themselves through social action by entering on a career in the secular world. I quote him, "In the economic, civil, social, and cultural order, she will be associated with men, and she should exercise prudence, tenderness, and a motherly instinct which is so necessary to compensate for administrative rigidity." End of quote. After citing other possibilities of fulfillment of a feminine attitude in various areas that he called the sphere of law, the area of communication, radio, and television, and the search for peace, Bishop Sheen concluded, "Every woman without exception is morally obligated, according to her capacity and condition in life, to realize one of these forms of motherhood." Unlike Archbishop Hallinan, Bishop Sheen did not start from what man can do, but from what he cannot do. The case presented by the bishop rests on the conviction that woman has a unique role and function, which he identifies with motherhood. In this, of course, he cannot emulate male behavior, but can only follow her psychological instincts and her physiological determinations. But the bishop goes beyond biology by extending the concept of motherhood to the spiritual, economic, civic, social, and cultural fields. He accepts the scholastic view that woman can be adequately defined as a prospective mother, all other aspects of her being and behavior being ancillary to this. Theologically, Bishop Sheen finds status for this in the New Testament and the feminine types that appear on its pages. Ethically, he concludes the moral duty on the part of all women to fulfill themselves through motherhood in at least one of its many forms. Linguistically, however, woman has been contrasted not with man as mankind, but with man as male. She keeps as her own property the tasks for which the male is not fitted. So this problematic functions entirely within the second quadrilateral of meaning that I have mentioned. Now, if we compare the suggestions made by these two bishops, we see that they have one identical concern, the promotion of woman in the church and in the world. But they have been inspired by radically diverging principles. One project takes man as mankind, as the standard, and then it joins forces with a contemporary view of democratic equality to demand for woman the legal enjoyment of all the liberties of man. From this point of view, ultimately, mankind is made of only one sex, man, whom woman should imitate. The other project takes man as male, as the standard, and it gives woman the ideal of reaching a unique and purely feminine status, that of mother. Ultimately, we have two sexes, males and mothers. The perennial problem of language about woman looms large behind the social-cultural aspects and factors in the recommendations made by the two bishops along these two lines. Is woman a part of the mankind which man is, or is she the female endowed with specific organs and corresponding functions that are her very own? This raises the question, is there any way for a theology or philosophy of womanhood to escape the ambiguities of our language? In a little known speech of the 29th of October 1966, Pope Paul VI painted a profound and profoundly moving vision of womanhood. The Pope was speaking to a congress of Italian gynecologists. If this had been Pius XII, he would have entered into all kinds of details about their art, and he would have discussed recondite medical problems. Pope Paul VI doesn't make that kind of speech. Instead, he contrasted two views of woman. One view, that of the doctors, by method considers her to be an object of scientific study. And this is necessary, he explained, to arrive at a better knowledge of the problems and processes of female physiology. But there is also another view to which he drew attention. The Pope introduced his own description with these words. At this moment, it is not so much your knowledge and your art which prompt our thinking as the ideal value, the symbolic significance, the sacred and lofty vision that our religious doctrine and our humanistic training attribute to the feminine creature, to woman. End of quote. As contrasted with the scientific view of doctors and researchers, this theology or philosophy of woman dwells in the realm of symbolism. But the symbolism is not the old symbolism, very old in Christian literature, that we may associate with the name of Tertullian, who wrote a little book addressed to his wife in which he said, "You are the gate of the devil." Now, far from looking at woman in the perspective of evil, of Eve, the tempted who turned temptress, of the wiles which male psychology attributes, rightly or wrongly, to womanhood, it turns in the opposite direction, toward a perception of goodness beauty and oneness. Pope Paul enters this horizon with full awareness of its symbolic structure. He admits it quite clearly. Quote, "It may be that our perspective is deeply steeped in feelings and poetry and expressed in the manifold language of supra-sensory values which belongs to the anthropology of faith as well as to a metaphysical and deontological conception of human life." End of quote. So after having introduced his point of view and indicated its inherent limits, Pope Paul continued, at this point I have a fairly long quotation. I should warn you that the typist who typed this text confessed to me that as she was typing this quotation, she was getting madder and madder by the line. And she threatened to refuse to type anything else of this kind, which I put in her hands. So I told her it wasn't the content of the quotation that should concern her, it was the use I make of it in the following pages. So if you find yourself getting mad, I ask you to exercise some self-control and sit there quietly. Perhaps you'll like it, you never know. "For us," Pope Paul said, "woman is a reflection of a beauty greater than herself. The sign of a goodness which appears to us as having no bounds. The mirror of the ideal human being as conceived by God in his own image and likeness. For us, woman is a vision of virginal purity which restores the most lofty affective and moral feelings of the human heart. For us, she is, in man's loneliness, the arrival of his companion who knows the supreme gift of love, the value of cooperation and help, the strength of fidelity and diligence, the common heroism of sacrifice. For us, she is the mother, the mysterious source of human life, whose nature still receives the breath of God, the creator of the immortal soul. For us, she is the creature who is the most docile to education, and therefore she is equipped for all cultural and social functions, especially for those which are most congenial with her moral and spiritual sensibility. For us, she is mankind as adopting the best attitude before the attraction of the sacred. Mankind which, when it wisely follows this attraction, elevates and sublimates itself in a most authentic expression of womanhood. Mankind which, whether it sings, prays, sighs, or weeps, seems naturally to converge toward a unique and supreme, spotless and sorrowful figure, the privileged woman blessed among all women, the Virgin Mother of Christ, Mary. Such is, gentlemen," he said, "the level at which we encounter woman." This is the end of my quotation. Whatever one may say about some of the notations in this long quotation, and I think I could criticize it, I find it very interesting that this text opens a rather different perspective from the idealization of womanhood that I found in the communication coming from Bishop Sheen at the Vatican Council. The bishop had started from the scriptural exemplification of woman in the Virgin Mary, in whose light he looked at the tasks and functions of women in society. The Pope's speech begins with womanhood perceived in its terrestrial embodiment through the light of faith in an anthropology which is theocentric before being philosophical, and it ends up with the Virgin Mary seen as the highest concretization of womanhood. If we analyze this text, we can distinguish in it several distinct layers, complementary layers in the vision that is proposed of woman. First, we have woman as exemplifying the goodness of the Creator, and specifically the true meaning of creation in God's image and likeness. Secondly, we have woman as providing insight into the ultimate moral and spiritual purity. Thirdly, we have woman as man's companion, who is not just a comrade, but brings with her the true meaning of self-gift. Fourthly, there is woman as source of life, and as ultimately united to God's creative act in her own conception of human life. Fifthly, there is woman as disciple and student, particularly suited to the pursuit of cultural and social values. And finally, there is woman as embodying human religious aspirations, and at this level, the orientation of womanhood toward an ideal yet real woman, the Virgin Mary, is quite explicit. The Pope, then, in that speech, unfolds a sixfold vision of woman, which for him sums up both the Christian insights and the highest human desires. We can, of course, ask what man, the male, becomes in such a vision, in which the very best of mankind as a whole is symbolized in and through woman. Well, man is called upon to look at this vision, to follow it where it leads, to give thanks for the goodness of the Creator, for the perception of the moral order, for the reception of the gift of love, for the source of life, for the cultural and social capacities and contributions of woman, for entering into a religious universe focused on the blessed vision of peace. But of course we may add that the Pope is depicting a symbol rather than an achieved reality. These categories ring true in the realm of typology, not in that of the down-to-earth embodiments of womanhood that one may be or that one may meet. And he knows that very well. This is why he spoke of poetry at the beginning. What is described here is an example, an archetype, a divine idea, which women of flesh and blood can only approximate. One may find this description unreal. It is a dream. Perhaps it is a myth, with little relation to actual women and to the practical tasks of womankind. Whatever devotion one may feel toward her, Mary is only Mary. Not all women are called to be the same. And it requires a good deal of imagination to see what Gertrude von Lefort called eternal woman, embodied in what she also called woman in time. Nor is the Christian woman of today likely to become the woman outside of time, in which Gertrude von Lefort sees the meeting point of the eternal feminine and the daily experience of womanhood. More critically, one may remark that the orientation of feminine life in the description made by Pope Paul lies away from herself. She reflects. She points to something other than herself. She accompanies man, comforting him and wooing away his loneliness. She is the source of another life. In her social endeavors, she places herself at the service of culture and society. What she can be in herself gives way to what she is for others, Her personality is not hers, it is mankind's. Behind this perspective, there is an old and venerable Christian tradition. In our century, we find it expressed in the works of Gertrude von Lefort, particularly her book on the eternal feminine. We find it in a poem by Teilhard de Chardin, also on the eternal feminine. We find it in theological essays by theologians like F.X. Arnold or William Hall in Germany and Jean Gallo in France. With more philosophical sophistication, it pervades the reflections of Edith Stein on the feminine vocation. And I'd like to sum it up in the words of the poet Paul Claudel in The Tidings Brought to Mary. The male is the priest, but it is not forbidden to woman to be the victim. Now, in which one of my two quadrilaterals of meaning does this line of thought operate? According to the authors we read, I think we find traces of both, so that neither the basic motivations of these views nor the perspective opened on the future of woman lack ambiguity. Yet it seems to me that the germ or the possibility of a third quadrilateral may be found here. In the Pope's address, for instance, it is quite remarkable that there is no contrast of woman directly with man as mankind or with man as male. The contrast is between the woman of today, inside or outside the church, and a heavenly model. This heavenly model is identified with the vision of the Virgin Mary, although there are some other authors, Catholic authors and also Orthodox, particularly Russian Orthodox authors, who find that heavenly model in the Holy Spirit. If this could be carried through consistently, you would have at hand another set of symbols, another diagram of quadrilateral of meaning in which the sense of the word woman and together with it its philosophical, cultural and social implications would not be determined by its contrast with man as mankind or with man as male, but by a heavenly archetype. Whether we find this model in the Virgin Mary of Catholic or Orthodox piety or in the Holy Spirit, it has to be placed ultimately in God. Thus, the connotations of womanhood would come not from woman before mankind, nor from woman before the male, but from woman before God. The reason why it is extremely difficult, perhaps impossible, to pursue this line of thinking systematically is that the religious and theological language cannot prescind from the limitations of the natural language which it is bound to use. And this language, as we have seen, operates with two other quadrilaterals of meaning. The third one emerges as a technical quadrilateral within the confines of theological parlance. It has not yet been adequately translated into any vernacular. I think this leads us to two tasks concerning the status of woman in the church and society and the movements for the liberation of woman. There is the task, on the one hand, to elucidate the context and draw out the implications of a strictly theological view of woman. in which the referent of the term, the key to its meaning, is not mankind or the male, but God. On the other hand, we have the task of translating this from the technical vocabulary of theology to the practical, everyday, lived vernacular of the people. Until we do this, these two tasks can be fulfilled, and Christian literature on woman will remain caught in what has been its central problem through the ages, namely its open schizophrenia, the existence of two parallel and largely contradictory streams, tending to see woman as weak and symbolic of temptation, or to idealize her as the pole of transcendent goodness in mankind and for man. The inferior place effectively assigned to woman in the organization of the Catholic Church reflects this hesitancy between two linguistic worlds, that of natural language and another, the exploration of which may hold the key to woman's total liberation. For the full meaning of woman before God can only be discovered by herself. It is from her own experience as a human being before God that a new language must be born, and with this new language, a new theology of womanhood. Unlike the theological anthropologies of old, which issued mainly from the reflection of men theologians, a new theological anthropology, insofar as it will include a theology of woman, must arise from the meaning of the feminine experience, not before mankind or before the male, but before God. This emphasis on the concreteness of woman requires that we shy away from thinking of womanhood as a general concept to be particularized in the existence of each woman. What we need is a theology of concrete woman as she is in the context of her life. And this is all the more possible within Catholic thinking, as Catholicity has always been focused on the concreteness of the sacramental experience. It is not satisfied with preaching a new gospel, with proclaiming an absolute word from God. It is also concerned with the specific forms of approach that God himself has endowed with numinous power among his manifold mercies. God does not come only to man, he comes to man in Christ, that is, in an enfleshed situation as one man among a multitude of men. Since the Ascension and Pentecost, Christ reaches men through the innumerable lanes of the Spirit, who also becomes, though in a different manner, a Spirit incarnate. One may speak of the aesthetics of revelation because the Spirit works like an artist who selects the proper medium for the effect he seeks. Thus, the sacraments confront us with realities from this world: bread, wine, water, oil, gestures, words, actions, which channel divine grace and through which the Spirit activates the presence of the Lord among us. Men and women also are imbued with sacramental power, as is clear in the sacrament of marriage, in the lives and activities of the prophetic personalities we call saints, in the sense of the sacred inspired by the liturgical actions, in the sense of peace and serenity which some persons radiate. In this sacramental universe, we do not look at things whose meaning ends and dies with themselves, but things are also symbols whose scope extends indefinitely, opening up vistas on the invisible world. What can be the meaning of male and female in this world? What symbolic implications are carried by the person who, as he passes from childhood to adolescence, discovers that he has not been made just a human being, but precisely this type of human being, that he or she is man or woman, that being human is experienced along two distinct, if related, lines by those we call men and those we call women. Thus, does this last word, woman, imply an addition to man, or, as medieval authors believe, a subtraction from man? And suppose it would imply neither addition nor subtraction, but simply otherness. What kind of otherness is this, and what meaning does it have? Above all, manhood and womanhood are not objective data, alien to the life that meets them, but they are experiences in which human beings are subjectively involved to a greater extent than one could suspect before the advent of Freud. This series of questions and problems points to the urgency of elaborating a Christian anthropology that has been updated from what it was with the scholastics. Pope Paul's speech to the Italian gynecologists mentions in passing the existence of an anthropology of faith. But I'm afraid that if there is one, this is still largely embryonic. And as I think I have shown, it is still too ambiguous to be entirely satisfactory. We have in fact several anthropologies which imply diverse evaluations of sex, diverse understandings of the purposes of marriage, different moral judgments on activities relating to sex, different opinions as to the advisability of introducing women into the governing offices of the church, different positions on the possibility of ordaining women to the priesthood, different spiritualities also, which vary in their appreciation of the nature and role of the male-female relationship in love and friendship. These divergences cannot remain academic, but they inspire opposite philosophies relating to education, co-education, different understandings of the authority of parents, and the generation gap is not so much caused by differences in age as by differing philosophies of life. It rests on anthropologies with incompatible orientations and assumptions. As a conclusion, I will restate the heart of the question for a theology of woman or a theological anthropology. The fundamental problem, I believe, is that of language. The way to solve it is to contrast woman with God as referent rather than with mankind or male, which were universally used in the past in Christian theology and are still universally used today in secular thought. The key to this may be a reflection on the implications of sacramental theology as it affects the religious meaning of each concrete woman. But this has to be done by woman herself, who must determine our goals, our ambitions, our capacities, our vocations, our demands before God. The second problem is to draw out the consequences of this new language for the structure and organization of the Christian community. Our present structures still express the old language about woman, not the new language, which is not yet born. The third problem is to translate these insights and meanings into the vernacular of everyday life, so that the liberated Christian woman of tomorrow is not only the one who is theologically sophisticated and can speak a theological language, but is also the relatively uncultured, simple woman of our average city, who should not be expected to learn a theological language in order to find her place among the people of God. Thank you. For an answer, there would be time for a few questions. If you have any, and I know the answer, I'd be glad to say them.
It seems like part of the problem with language and contrasting women to God is that you get back to male and to God, at least, you know, kind of very deep inside people. What, you know, what about that? What do you do?
Of course, I'm aware that this is one of the difficulties, that in God, we speak of God in male terms, too. Of course, you know that there have been attempts in the past in Christian theology to speak of God not only in male terms, but in female terms, too. You may be familiar with Julian of Norwich, happened to be a woman, this English mystic in the 14th century, who, in a book called Revelations of Divine Love, speak of God as mother, too. Not just father, but also mother. The thing I find odd, a little odd about it, is that the specific person she sees as the mother is Jesus. The Word of God, mankind, is not only our father but our mother, too, she says. There have been other attempts made to relate femininity more specifically to the Holy Spirit. For those who are learned of the Semitic languages, help here, because the word for spirit in Hebrew happens to be feminine word. Well, that's in languages where words have gender. However, I don't think it's among that kind of speculation that we can find it, we can find an answer. And I'm not too satisfied either with the sort of solution we find in some such churches as the Christian Scientists. I don't know if you have ever heard a Christian Science service over the radio or something of the kind. In the version of the Lord's Prayer, which is given, you have the Lord's Prayer and then the paraphrase. And I think it begins something like this, Our Father. And after the paraphrase is Our Father, Mother. Well, if I knew what father mother means, maybe I could accept it, but I don't really know. No. I don't think we can either find a solution in speaking of God in neutral terms. It, no. The great it. And that doesn't help too much. No. And because you cannot speak, you cannot develop personal or interpersonal relationship in terms of it, at least since Martin Buber, we cannot do it. I'm afraid that we'll have to live for quite a while with God in seen in masculine terms. The main point is that we have to understand that these terms apply to God only negatively, like all the terms we use about him. The language, even the most positive language we have to speak about God, is meant to be taken at such a high degree of analogy that it no longer applies strictly, literally, in the way we pronounce the words. This, of course, requires a certain degree of intellectualism to reason it out. That when we speak of God as Father, it doesn't mean fatherhood as we know it. If we speak of him as he or him, it doesn't mean him or he as we know that. It cannot mean her or she as we know her or she either. And it cannot mean it. It means something totally different. It means God. And I think it would be better simply to use the word God, in trying not to qualify it as masculine or feminine. But this is difficult. We have to learn to speak again. And you have to learn to speak from childhood. Most we have to reverse the language we have learned. This is why I say what is required is a new language. It's not just a new conception of woman. That will not be sufficient. It's a new language, and that includes a new way of speaking about God. I don't think it it helps to replace father by something else, like mother. I don't mind calling God mother if I find it meaningful. I don't find it meaningful. At least I'm used to father, and I know what it means, and I know it's not meant literally. Especially in special place of motherhood in American culture. I wouldn't like to see God called mother on this continent. Good in mommies, I mean. Well, see, I didn't want to go into the discussion of the contents of the description made by Pope Paul. I think I would have the same criticism, basically, that you have. I wanted to use that as indicating at least a direction, the possibility of another type of language in which woman is not seen in contrast with man or in contrast with mankind, but in contrast with God. And I think this is what he's trying to do. I don't think he does it very well. No. But he does it within a certain tradition. No. And that's what I find interesting there. No. Well, see, we have a similar ambiguity with man, because the word man means both mankind and male.
But that's not true. I think the series is a very masculine analysis of the whole problem. It assumes a whole part, the be of women to not accept.
What do I assume? If this is the way I have been understood, I must have explained myself very badly. and of course, that's quite possible. Because I'm not inventing the fact that the word man means mankind and means also male. I mean, this is a fact. I may not like it. But this is the language we all use, because this is the language that is at our disposal. I'm not saying that man is adequately described in that way, not at all. But this is the language we have. Now, if I was making a speech to a man who minister about the meaning of man. No, I think I would end up pretty much the same place. No. That the word, the content of the word man has to be assessed again, not simply in terms of mankind or in contrast with female, but in contrast with God, man before God.
Yes.
Yeah, I think if we try to approach it from person as such, my understanding of person sees absolutely no distinction between man as person or woman as person. So they are, the result is that we are not helped in our understanding of either man or woman. Because we don't... It helps us to understand person, but not man as person or woman as person. Or, if you like, it helps us to understand person, but not feminine person or masculine person. So we are left entirely with the same problem. No.
I think we move out of the problem now.
No. You're pushing the problem further. Right? I mean, of course we have to develop our sense of person, particularly as when person is understood and not simply in terms of individuality, but in terms of interrelationships. But as soon as you speak of interrelationships, you find that the very top of interrelationships in mankind is the male-female interrelationship. No. This was said by Karl Marx a long time ago. and you are still faced by the same problem. So I have no objection in taking it from the point of view of person, but that's delaying the real problem.